All right, good morning, everybody. We're going to be in John 6, 1 through 21. If you're using the booklets, it's lesson number 12. And just so everybody's aware, this morning, Craig Bradley is in town along with his whole family, and he's going to be preaching for us this morning, and then his son, Morgan. How long have you been preaching now? 1 year. Cool. So the son of Craig is going to be preaching for us tonight. So we're going to have father and son, which is going to be kind of cool to have that happen for us. And that's my son, Asher, crying. All right. We'll talk about the outline chart again in just a moment, but Scott's going to open us up in a word of prayer. Let's just remind ourselves of the overall picture of the Gospel of John. John says at the end of the book that he's writing so that you may believe and that this belief would create life. When he talks about how this belief creates life, it's not just like an eternal kind of thing. The idea is that it's a better state of life that starts now and lasts into eternity. So every story that we look at in John's Gospel is supposed to make us deepen our faith in Christ, which is supposed to give us a greater sense of life. That's the overall picture of John. The first 12 chapters show you his public ministry, which emphasizes a lot of the signs that he does. And then 13 to 21, for the most part, he's spending that section with his 12 apostles or 11 apostles because Judas has left. And he's giving them his final discourse in the upper room. We've noted before that if you were to look at the totality of John's Gospel and add up how many days in the life of Jesus it is, it's 21 days. And so every single thing that this Gospel records is very critical. That's true about the whole Bible. But John has condensed the 3.5 years of Jesus' ministry into 21 days that he thinks are really critical that we know. So when we look at this event in chapter 6 of John, this is going to be one of the miracles that is recorded in all four of the Gospels. But remember that beginning in John 5, we have this pattern where Jesus will do a sign, then there's going to be a discussion about it, and then Jesus is going to basically preach a sermon about it. We saw that when Jesus healed the man at the pool of Bethesda. We're going to see that in this chapter. So in 1 through 21, we're going to see the sign itself. And then in the following weeks, we'll see the dialogue and the discourse that Jesus gives in light of that. And so that happens several times in John's Gospel. Before we read the text, let me just remind you of the context. Go back to John chapter 5 really quick and look at how John chapter 5 ended. In John chapter 5, verses 19 to 47, Jesus made all kinds of claims about himself, and then he backed it up with different witnesses or evidences. And one of the evidences that he had for his claims was Moses' writing. So look at John 5, 45 to 47. "Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" So Jesus is speaking to people that claim to believe in Moses and says to these people that if you were to read Moses carefully, you'd realize that he was talking about me all over the place, which leads into chapter 6, where Jesus is going to show in two different ways how he's greater than Moses. He's going to give them bread in the wilderness, and then he's going to walk on water. How do those two things connect to Moses?
Moses gave them water in the desert.
Okay. Yeah, out of the rocks. Okay, what else did Moses do in connection to water? Yeah, parted the Red Sea. So Moses parts the Red Sea, obviously God working through him. And then they walk on the dry land. Here's Jesus, and he's going to walk on the water. So he's greater than Moses. What was Moses' relationship to giving the Israelites bread in the wilderness? the manna, right? And so here Jesus, the bread's not going to just fall down from heaven. Jesus is going to take some loaves of bread and actually multiply it himself. So on both counts, the end of chapter 5, Moses wrote of me, and I'm greater than Moses in chapter 6. All right? So we'll see that in how this is structured. All right. The way that I want to do this is kind of like we did it last week, where I'm going to have a couple discussion questions up on the board. And here's the first one that I want you guys to think of. As this text is being read, what do these two stories or scenes have in common? One of the things that's important to know when you're studying the Gospels is to try to see the flow of thought. A lot of the times we can look just at the feeding of the 5,000 and just give up a bunch of lessons from that and then move to the next scene and give a bunch of lessons from that. But John's putting this in this order for a reason. So as this is being read, try to be thinking about this question. What do these two stories share in common? All right, who wants to read the text? Virginia?
After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming forward and said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?"
Thanks, Virginia. Okay, so what do you guys think for this question? What are these two stories sharing in common with each other? Okay, there's food, but connected to the crossing when Jesus walks on the water. So the feeding and then the walking on water. What are they sharing in common? Yeah. Okay, good. So in the first story, you've got Jesus able to take bread, which comes from barley and everything like that, and he's able to multiply it just on the spot. And then in the next one, he's walking on water. So he's showing authority over nature in both of them. Good. What other connections do they share? Virginia? Okay. All right. Peggy?
You know, people always criticize Peter. But you know what? He's the only one that walked on water for a little bit before he lost his faith and started to sink. At least he had the faith to get out of the boat and try. And when I'm having problems with trying to do things, I mean, about that, basically, it is.
Okay. Yeah, this one doesn't record Peter walking on water. That's in the other Gospels, but this is when that event happened. But try to think about this question again. What do these two scenes share in common with each other? Yeah, Roy?
They're both miracles.
Okay, good. So they're both miracles, and in John's Gospel, they're both signs. When John uses the word sign, it's like saying that this miracle is a symbol. How many signs are in John's Gospel? Seven. Number seven is all over the place in John's Gospel. The first two are numbered, and you kind of have to guess after the second one which ones are constituting as signs. But that means that when we look at this, and we'll get into this question in just a little bit, what are the deeper meanings of these signs? You guys ever heard people talk about Jesus turning the water to wine? And they say, well, that means we get to drink. Well, all of these signs, you're supposed to look for a deeper meaning. Don't stay at the superficial meaning of these things. And that's going to be the problem of this crowd that we're going to see in the next lesson, in the next section, is that they just looked at the superficial ideas of these things, and they missed the boat, as it were, which is kind of funny because they're in a boat in this text. All right, but what other connections do you see between these two stories? What do they share in common? Scott? Okay, very good. In verse 6, Jesus is testing the disciples, and he knows what he's going to do. But Jesus, when he wants them to find out if they have enough bread to feed all the people, he's asking these questions, Jesus is asking these questions to help them realize their inadequacy. Like, he says, hey, like, let's take care of this problem. And I think Jesus wants them to realize, we can't do this on our own. And then in the next scene, when they're on the boat, do the disciples realize pretty quickly they don't have the power and the strength to manage the storm by themselves? So in both scenes, you have the inadequacy of the disciples, which then is solved by the power of Jesus. Are you going to say something, Miranda?
Just kind of going off of that, both are involved here, of God.
Yes. Yes, very good. And in both cases, Jesus is going to be the answer to the fear, right? So you can start to see how some of these things might apply to our life, Roy. Yes. And specifically in the context of the Old Testament, too, not only is he greater than nature, but he's greater than Moses, because these are similar things that what Moses did. All right, anything else you guys see about that question? What do they share in common? Yeah.
One, I know it seems like there was a crowd near each one, because, you know, he like, the boat and the crowd follows him, it's like, he's probably like, okay, I got this now, so. It just seems like, okay, do we have enough to feed these people? No, but there's a kid over there with some barley and fish. Okay, it's like, hang on. Okay, go ask them for some barley. We can feed these people. And then have them all sit down because there's, you know. But what's funny is, people don't know this, but I figured there was more than 5,000 people there.
Yeah, this is just saying the 5,000 men.
Men, yeah, I figured there must have been women and children.
Women and children, yeah.
Which would have meant there have been more, like, more, a whole lot more than that.
Okay, so then try to think about Barry and then Mark.
I was just going to say that from the first one, he's a provider, and the second one, he's a protector. And then he goes into his telling them about how they have to take him in to themselves, and that will eventually lead to provision and protection spiritually.
Okay, good. So the boat, when they take him in, is what you're saying?
No, he's protecting them from the waves. They're getting nowhere.
Right.
And they're getting exhausted. And so he comes and protects them from the waves, calms the sea, and then takes them, provides for them to go across. So he's both provider and protector. And that can be seen spiritually. And then he starts talking to them about how they have to really absorb his teachings.
Right, good.
Right,
very good. This shows the deeper meaning of some of these signs. Jesus is going to say that if you want to come to me, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. Like, if you really want my provisions and my protection, you've got to take the things that I've taught. That's not talking about the Lord's Supper when he says, eat my flesh and drink my blood. He's talking about taking his teachings and, like, taking them into your life. And that's where he's going in this discussion. Mark?
Another number that has some significance to it as well. We have
Very good. That's a good point. Let me say one more thing about how these sections, what they share in common. I said earlier that there's parallels to Moses. We had the two obvious ones. I'm going to just machine gun through some of these, but look at verse 6. Jesus is testing them in the wilderness. Does that sound like anything God did in the Old Testament? Remember when the Israelites start complaining that they don't have food and water, things like that? Look at verse 4. What time of the year is it? Passover. That reminds you of Moses as well and the Israelites in the Old Testament. Look at verse 3. Where does Jesus sit down on?
Mountain.
Go down to verse 15. Where does Jesus withdraw to? A mountain. Does that remind you of Moses going to Mount Sinai? Look at verse 20. When Jesus gets in the boat and he says, "It is I, do not be afraid." Does anybody know what that literally says in the Greek? Yeah.
I am.
Does that remind you of when God spoke to Moses at the burning bush and he said, "I am"? Look at just the walking over the water, which we've already talked about. All right, very good. All right, so you see how these things are supposed to be interrelated, which means that we look at these two scenes together. All right, so let's ask this question. What are the deeper meanings of these signs? So it is, oh, cool, he walked on water. Oh, cool, he multiplied bread. In verse 15, the crowd didn't realize there was a deeper meaning. Because what does the crowd want to do in verse 15? Yeah, they want to take him by force and make him king. Now, when I first was reading John's gospel, and for a few years, I used to think that this meant they were like grabbing Jesus and be like, "Come on, you're the king. Come on, you better be the king. We're gonna force you." I don't think that's what this means. I think the idea is they've got their swords ready and they're like, "All right, Jesus, let's go. We're gonna go kill the Roman Empire." I don't think they're pushing him into the throne. I think they're thinking, "This guy is the king. Let's go take it by force now." So they didn't realize that there was a deeper meaning to what was happening here. And this means that this is the danger that we can have when we study texts like this. What is the deeper meaning of this? Peggy? Very good. Look at verse 11. When they distributed the loaves, it says, this is something I underlined in my workbook, that they ate as much as they wanted. I went to an all-you-can-eat sushi place on Thursday, and I could not eat a lot of it. But I didn't even get the all-you-can-eat platter because I wouldn't have been able to do that. But the guy that I was with, he ate a ton of it. Like here Jesus is giving all-you-can-eat bread to these people. Like, there's no limitation on what you can have. But even after they've had their fill in verse 12, notice that they were satisfied with the food. They had their fill. There's still leftovers. Now, he says, "Gather these up so that nothing may be lost." In chapter 6, verse 39, a few verses down in the same chapter, Jesus is going to talk about not losing any of the disciples that belong to him. So maybe there's some interesting connections to make from that. But there's 12 baskets. How many apostles are there? Maybe one of the lessons in this is the apostles who didn't think that they could feed all of these people afterwards are left holding a basket with more than what they even started with. Like, so it's like a visual lesson to them. Jesus will completely satisfy, and he has more than we can even handle with the provisions that he can give to us spiritually. Peggy? Okay. All right. What? Yeah, Tamara?
I was thinking the disciples are still thinking in a limited fashion.
Yes.
They just haven't opened up their mind. It's like, oh, this is the Messiah. They still haven't gotten it.
No, yeah. It's still a long ways to go for them. And Scott's been studying through the Gospel of Mark with somebody, and Scott made an interesting comment a few months ago that when you study through the gospel, like a gospel with somebody, it's like we see the failures of the disciples to understand what's happening, But when you're actually studying it with somebody who has no background in the Bible, you actually see the person you're studying with go through the same struggles. And it's not till like you get to the end of the gospel and maybe look at a few other books of the Bible that things really start to connect with people. And so like their failure to understand matches our failure to understand when we're first reading some of these things as well. So very good. Peggy? All right, anything else you guys want to say about the deeper meanings of these signs? Yeah, Scott? Okay, good. Good. And this miracle is in some ways looking forward to what Jesus is going to do. Remember at the Last Supper, as we call it? The other Gospels, when Jesus feeds the 5,000, give more detail about this, but it says that Jesus blessed the bread and broke it, which is similar to what he does at the Last Supper, right? He takes the bread, he breaks it, and he blesses it, and he says, "This is my body broken for you." And so this scene, I think, is looking forward to the broken body of Jesus that's multiplied for everybody in the world, that in verse 11, people can have as much as they want of it, and as much as you have, there's still going to be some left over. You're never going to understand all of it. You're never going to be able to take it all in. But Jesus is the one that was broken to feed the multitude, which is us. Craig, were you going to say something? Yes. So let's talk about this then. And all of these questions kind of get interrelated. The third question, how are you encouraged despite your inadequacies? Like, I don't know what it is in your life that, like, maybe you kind of feel like you might be able to do for the Lord. But there's times during the week or there's times where we start thinking a little bit differently about that. And we're like, I just don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can teach somebody. I don't know if I could lead songs. I don't know if I could do blah, 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 blah. How do both of these stories encourage you? Ida? Yes, and I think this is why in verse 6 again, like look at verse 5, start in verse 5. It says in verse 5, lifting up his eyes then and seeing a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? How would you describe the attitude of the disciples here?
Negative.
Yeah, it's negative. Like, Jesus is asking this question that's really hard. It doesn't seem like there's any good answer to this. And then they say, well, we did look around and we found this little kid's lunch and we took the lunch from him. But what is this able to do for so many people? All right, how do we do the same thing today?
But if that's all we
How do we be like the disciples here? Yeah. Good. Yeah, the disciples are focusing on the great large crowd. And then when they give these meager portions to Jesus, like, well, this is all we got. And Jesus is like, okay, I'll take that. I'll use that. I'll give you whatever, I'll use whatever you give me. And I'm going to take whatever you give me and I'm going to multiply it. So you ever wonder, okay, well, I don't know if I'm able to teach a class. I don't know if I can preach a sermon. I don't know if I could go help some people. I don't think I could do any of these things. Like, there's people that are better than me at these things. There's people that are more talented. There's people that blah, blah, blah. And we start thinking about all of the things that we can't do. And then Jesus is here saying, well, what do you have? I'm going to take what you have, and then I'm going to make that work because I'm the one that's working through you. So you give him what you have, and then you see what he does with it. Yeah. Right. And this isn't to suggest that if you're going to step out and use like a gift for your first time, that it's going to be like, feed 5,000 people. That's right. Rock star. Like, you have to hone those abilities and grow and things like that. So there's some ways in which these parallels break down when we start making some of those kinds of applications. But you give God what you have and you see what he does with it is the point. I thought I saw some other hands. Right. Yeah, I think sometimes when we focus on our inadequacies, let's think about this in your own life. The times that you've focused on what you don't have and what you can't do and the very little that you do have, what has that caused you to do in your life?
Not tried.
So do you think that's something that Satan probably wants us to believe? Like, I don't, there's really nothing I can do, like, whatever. And then people aren't giving the little that they have to God, and then nothing gets multiplied because of that. So we have to get less attention on ourselves and more attention on the God who can take the meager rations and do something great with it. Anything else you guys want to say about that question? Yeah. Right. Well, look at verse 2. This crowd comes to him because they saw how great his teaching was. Did I read that wrong? They saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Sweet, fireworks. Those are cool. So then after Jesus does more fireworks in verse 14, when the people saw the signs that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Let's kill Rome." The disciples into the boat, the 12. Yeah, that, well, it's distinguishing between the crowd that wants to take him by force. The other gospels, like in Mark, after Jesus feeds the 5,000, the Greek word for when Jesus is making the disciples go away, it's a very forceful kind of word. Like Jesus forced the disciples to get into the boat. And some people think that when you put John and Mark together, that what's happening with the disciples is they're starting to get wrapped up into this mindset of storming the Roman Empire and killing them. So Jesus is like, you get away, you separate for now, because we need to talk about these things and how this is not my mission. But, yeah, I don't know. All right. But look at when you look at verses 2 and 14 again, they saw the signs, and then after Jesus did another sign, what do they want? Like, they didn't see the deeper meaning. They just want to make him king. So look at what Jesus does with them in verse 15. He withdraws from them. Does Jesus withdraw from people? Like, if Jesus has been with people and he provided some things that they needed, does Jesus ever get to a point where he says, all right, I'm going to have to withdraw from you? What kind of people does he do that to? And try to answer it in this text. Yeah, people that are not seeing the deeper meaning of what he came to do, people that are wanting Jesus just for some kind of physical thing. Do you remember the first question that Jesus asks in John's gospel? What are you seeking? This is a great question. It's the first question in John's gospel. The first question Jesus asks, what are you seeking? Now, what are some reasons that people seek Jesus today? Or appear to be seeking Jesus? Yeah, Scott?
I've talked to people that you can tell they really want Jesus to make their life better. You know, their situations, maybe their health or their sadness or whatever it may be. But, you know, it's hard to get them to see things like this, to see there's so much more.
Right. Right. So the people that want to use Jesus as a means to an end, Jesus says to those people, I'm going to withdraw from you. Like, you're just seeking me, you're just, like, doing all these things just because you're seeking something. You're hoping that I'm, like, a stepping stone to some kind of peace in your life. You're hoping I'm a stepping stone to make your marriage better. You're hoping I'm a stepping stone to make your physical health better. Or you're hoping that I'm a stepping stone or a means to an end to make your finances in better order because you think you're going to be blessed in those kinds of ways. And Jesus, with those kinds of people that have that kind of mindset towards him, withdraws from them. Yeah, Roy?
Sometimes those are the cases that open the door where people find deeper meaning.
They are, but if they don't find the deeper meaning and they stick at the surface level, then Jesus withdraws from such people. Because in John's gospel, Jesus' signs, did they bless people? Yes. Were they good that Jesus did the signs? Yes. But if you never go beyond the signs and you're just looking for these physical things, that's the kind of person that in John's gospel, they believe in Jesus, but they're not saved. Mark, and then Kristen.
It's interesting that he withdrew by himself. He didn't take his disciples with him. And it's, you know, when we think about the stories we've already read, they know that he has healed people who are on deathbed, somebody who was crippled for 38 years or kind of long. And they still don't, you know, they still don't get it.
Yeah. It's very, this is not an outdated book at all. Kristen?
He withdraws from the people who want Jesus to do for them, but they're not willing to put the work in themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not submitting to the things that he said about that. You're just hoping that he's kind of like the good luck charm that changes everything. Good, good. And, yeah, Morgan?
These are people trying to force him to be king. They're not happy with who he is. They're going to make him something that they want him to be.
Very good. This is a good point. This is an idol, right? Like Jesus, like, this is what we want you to do. This is what we came to you to do for us. Do people ever do that with Jesus? Where I came to Jesus and I was expecting this and it didn't happen. So then later on in this same chapter, these people are going to grumble about the bread that came down from heaven, which is Jesus. Does that remind you of the Israelites in the Old Testament? They grumbled about the manna because that's all they had for the 40 years, besides some quail every now and then. But when Jesus isn't doing what they want them to do, like you're trying to try to force Jesus, well, who's really God in that case then? When you're insisting that Jesus do things in a certain way for your life, who do you really think is God? You think you are. These people in verse 15 are acting like they're above Jesus, saying, you're going to be the king, but we're the ones that are going to make it happen. Like, this is our prerogatives here. All right, anything else? Greg?
They're wanting to come to God on their terms.
Yes. Right. And when we start looking at some things in the Bible that are really hard that Jesus said, that's where the rubber meets the road. Do you think you're weightier than God, or are you going to submit yourself to what he said no matter what it is? I saw a couple hands. Mark?
I just also think it's interesting. I can't help but wonder what Jesus is doing. He's obviously doing this. He's meditating on the life of his brain. And thinking about the way things have to occur. In other words, now's not the time. He could have very easily just succumbed to the crowd. And the Romans would have killed him absolutely, because anybody who was not supposed to be king was to be put to death. But it wasn't time. And so it's something to put ourselves in his position to see what he was going through with his father at this point, saying, who knew what he had to do? It just wasn't the time.
Yeah, and you kind of have to wonder if this is one of the times in Jesus' life where he did face temptation. Like, you got this whole crowd, like, up to 25,000 people. You're the king! You're awesome! Now, if that's you, and everybody's like, yeah, like, you're the guy, you're awesome, you're great, awesome. My temptation is, well, I like to hang around these people because they make me feel good. And Jesus withdraws from them because they don't have the right mindset about things. Peggy? Let's talk a little bit more about this walking on the water. We haven't dealt with that as much. But notice what time of the day it is. Is the sun up or sundown? It's evening in verse 16. In verse 17, it was dark. And light and dark is a big theme in John's gospel. And here you've got the strong wind blowing over the water. And how far have they gone out onto the sea? Yeah, like 3 to 4 miles. And here's Jesus walking on the sea. Now, does this remind you of anything in Genesis chapter 1? When the earth was this giant mass of water, and what was the Spirit of God doing? Hovering over the face of the deep. By the way, remember when Jesus was baptized, he was in the water, and then what descended upon him in the water? The Spirit did. So, and now you've got Jesus walking on the water. I think these things are indicating that Jesus is ushering in new creation. He's taking things that are in turmoil and in chaos and, like, messed up, like the disciples who are fearful here, and he's going to recreate them. I think there's all kinds of pictures of that in this section. And so they're rowing on the water, and it says that they were frightened when they saw Jesus. And Jesus tells them, don't be afraid, and he says, I am, do not be afraid. And it says here that they were glad to take him in the boat, and immediately the boat was at land to which they were going. Now, some people think that means that the boat just, like, zoomed to the shore as soon as he got into the water. Like, he's in, or got into the boat. He's in the boat, and then boom. Or it could just be saying that he got into the boat and no other major events happened, and then they got to the shore. I'm not sure which way to take that. But, Clay?
Well, the one thing that I don't get is, why didn't he just, stop the storm and then walk on the water to the boat? Because that's probably kind of why they were, because you figure it's a storm, so they're like, kind of probably huddling together. Being like, what's that?
Okay. What do you think we learned from this walking on the water business? What's the point of this part?
Don't be afraid to try some new things. Basically, as we were talking about, you have a little. Well, as I said, Peter had the courage to get out. And, sometimes we're afraid to try it because by speaking to people or talking to people, because we're afraid of the rejection. But when you realize you're not rejecting me, you're rejecting what you're talking about. I think that helps.
Okay. Why do you think Jesus allows them to be in the water when they're going through this? Why do you think Jesus allowed them to be tested when they fed the 5,000? Like, what is he trying to help them realize about themselves? You can't do this on your own. You need something outside of yourself to make it through the work that you have to do of feeding the multitude. You need something other than yourself to rely on when it comes to the storms of your life. You need to lean on me in order to handle these things. He's allowing them to go through these things. I think he's testing them in both stories for them to realize that you do not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. This is Deuteronomy. This is what God did with the Israelites in the Old Testament, just in a new form in Jesus. Mark and then Tamara. Right. And apart from Jesus, you're rowing and you're rowing and you're getting tired and exhausted. You're not getting anywhere. But then when Jesus gets into the boat, then that's when things start to happen. Like, it's like the oil that lubricates the engine, and you didn't have oil before and it was just seizing up. And when you let Jesus in and you start relying on him, it doesn't necessarily mean everything is going to get easy, but perspectives sure do change. Ida?
I think it's interesting.
Oh, Tamara. Sorry. I'm going to interrupt you. Tamara, I forgot you, but... And then we'll go back to you, Ida.
Jesus was allowing him to struggle.
Yes.
And then he's just walking through the storm or through the waves, and he's just, he's like, I'm in power. This is nuts. This is nothing.
Right.
When
you might think, all right, the disciples are rowing in the boat, things are really hard, they're exhausted, they're scared. Why are they in this situation? Is it because they're in sin? Why did they get in that position? Because Jesus wanted them to be there. He told them to get in the boat. He told them to get to the other side. Is it true that sometimes, like, obeying God will put you in difficult circumstances, and then in the midst of that, we have to learn to trust in him all the more? Ida?
That was my point.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
what I wanted to get at is that we end up trying to do it all by ourselves.
Yes. And if we try... We think our salvation depends on us. We're not getting anywhere with that. We're in the middle of the sea, and we're gonna sink. Unless we rely on the Lord, we're not gonna be able to feed the multitude. We're not gonna get to the other side. And by the way, this story with Jesus walking on the water, does this remind you of anything else in the Old Testament? Like a prophet named Jonah? Does that remind you of Jonah now? Jonah, he. In order to calm the storm, what did Jonah have to do? He had to be thrown over into the water. perhaps this is partly looking forward to how Jesus is going to ultimately calm the storms. He had to drown too. Like, he had to die in order to ultimately calm our storm of all the things that we ultimately face. Yeah.
Funny thing, you should mention Jonah, because in the case where Jesus was on the water, he was actually in the ship, you know, in the bow of the ship, asleep.
Right.
And that is the same bit that happened to Jonah, because Jonah was sleeping like, wait, you're causing this storm overboard.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the discussion, guys. That was a fun class.